Welcome to the Indisposable Podcast, produced by Upstream and supported this season by Patagonia. I'm your host, Brookine Gatewood. Thanks for joining for another episode celebrating solutions to plastic pollution. I'm here today with Stiv Wilson, who is a campaigns director for the Story of Stuff Project, which many of you may know has been making amazing educational videos about consumer culture since the original Story of Stuff movie came out in 2007. And Story of Stuff has become a powerful force for engaging millions of citizens in actions to shift away from the most harmful and needless forms of consumption. So the Story of Stuff has also become a core leader in the Break Free from Plastic movement, and Stiv is the project director for Story of Stuff's upcoming film coming out this fall, The Story of Plastic, which we'll hear a lot more about today. Before Story of Stuff, Stiv worked on plastic campaign strategy and communication at Five Gyres and Surfrider, which are two LA-based nonprofits. He's trained as a journalist and a photographer, and he's been a driving force behind some really big wins in the plastic movement over the last decade or so. So we're really pleased to have you with us here today, Stiv.
Thanks so much, Brookine. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So, Stiv, you're a veteran of sorts in this movement. You've been working on it for, I believe, over a decade. So I'm curious to hear a little bit about how this topic first got into your heart and what motivated you to dedicate so much of your life to this issue.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it's interesting how I got into the plastics issue. I started surfing a little over about 15 years ago, kind of later in life. And started surfing in Oregon, where I saw some plastic on a beach. And Oregon coastlines are pretty remote compared to other parts of the United States. And, you know, from where you surf at this one place I was at in Oregon, you can't see like a human-made object. So getting to the beach and finding all this plastic stuff, like my math brain was like, wow, how did this get here? And my sort of aesthetic philosopher brain, it's what I studied actually in college, was the theory of beauty, was really assailed by, you know, this plastic on the beach because it was so incongruent to the natural order. And that just led me down a rabbit hole that I haven't got to the bottom of yet. I mean, I started Googling, I started writing, was a freelance journalist at the time. And I started finding the few players that were in the movement at that time. And eventually, within a couple of years, started a campaign to ban plastic bags and got on a boat to sail to the garbage patches.
Wow. And over your time doing this work, you have been involved in a number of the early wins that have helped transform this from a fringe movement that, you know, even 3 years ago, a lot of people didn't really know about this issue. And now it's in the news almost every day. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the stepping stones that you've been involved in and the wins along the way to make plastic such a big issue in the global agenda right now.
So it's sort of like an interesting and winding path. And the way I sort of view my place in the movement is I'm sort of like working in concentric circles. I got curious and I started something small with a Surfrider chapter in Portland, Oregon. And at every victory, and the more I learned, I realized like how big the system was, like how much we're using this material, this plastic material, and how difficult it is to manage. And how much more of it is coming down the pipeline every single day. I mean, it is exponential growth. And what's really interesting about plastic, unlike climate change or ocean acidification or something, is you can see it and it accumulates. So I think the visual evidence of this problem is growing every day, just as the awareness is growing and just as the movement is growing that is trying to, you know, push back on the system. And I just kept asking questions, you know, you look at questions of, you know, where is this coming from? And that gets you all the way back to fracking. So, you know, you see the results in the ocean, but the more questions you ask, the farther upstream you get to what the source of the problem is. And so every campaign got a little bit bigger and a little larger in scope. And, you know, eventually got to a point where I realized I can't be one guy who is running campaigns. We need to create like solidarity and a factory for more people intervening in the system. So I sort of about 4 years ago, sort of like turncoat and said, instead of just being a campaign's leader, I want to be a part of building a movement. And that's exactly what we did.
Mm. So you had, I believe the Microbeads ban was in 2015, which was right before Break Free from Plastic started getting organized, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Microbeads ban was a really interesting sort of model. Like, I sailed around the world studying plastics in the ocean, contributing to a scientific paper that did the first global estimate of plastics in the ocean. And it was, you know, over 5 trillion particles, 280,000 metric tons. And when we published this paper, we got some decent press.
Was this with Five Gyres?
Yeah, this is when I was working, at Five Gyres, we published this paper. But the startling thing about it was what we recognized was that most people don't really identify with the middle of the ocean. And you know, following the sort of idea of we protect what we love, I'm originally from Minneapolis, and, you know, nobody was talking about plastic in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Minneapolis is about as far away from the ocean as you can get in North America. However, we have the Great Lakes, and the Great Lakes are a very special place for people in the Midwest and, you know, Canada and the United States. So we had the idea, let's look for plastic in the Great Lakes. And to our surprise, we found microbeads coming from personal care products, cosmetics, etc. And that caused an incredible stir and sort of changed the dialogue, because now plastic was an existential threat to places that real people cared about. Mm. Not these places off in the middle of nowhere. And that led to a pretty transformative campaign where, you know, we went after the companies producing them, because these were microbeads were designed to go into the environment as part of their use. So we felt this was pretty egregious. And, you know, and to that, also from an like a public understanding, the public freaked out when they found out that they were washing their face and brushing their teeth with plastic. It was just gross. Mm-hmm. And so we realized that, you know, the companies said what the companies were going to say, and we recognized that they're not going to phase these out, you know, in any time frame that's acceptable, or they're going to, you know, phase them out, put some other, like, another ingredient with unintended consequences in, or a plastic substitute that was just as bad. So we decided we needed to take a legislative approach. And about 100 NGOs worked on this. And we started by introducing bills in California and New York simultaneously to get international headlines. And we failed to pass it the first legislative season. But then in round two, we got 22 states to introduce in the next year. And that created a kind of chaos for industry, because they couldn't, you know, they couldn't push back on all of these policies. And our strategy was also to pass slightly different policies, knowing that industry has to have some guidelines to reformulate their products. And so that was the like death knell to them, when they recognized that, oh my gosh, our products are going to have different regulations in different states. This is, you know, going to be chaotic for our supply chain.
That's clever. So that you push them to create their own incentive to want to get some standards, sounds like.
Yeah. And when we passed the California policy, which was like the strongest bill, when I went to Washington, D.C. to negotiate federal legislation, you know, it's a rare time in your activist career where you have all the leverage in the world. Like, these are the days you remember above all else, because there's so few and far between. But I remember negotiating it and saying, you know, straight up, I don't care if we pass a federal ban at all, because we knew that the California policy was strong enough that it was going to end. The market in California is big enough that companies would have to formulate to that standard anyway. So we were able to negotiate federal legislation saying, give us the environmental language and control over what kind of substitutes you're going to use. and then we'll give you preemption. We'll make a uniform policy across the United States. And it was basically a take it or leave it moment. And they said, you know, it's more important to have uniform guidelines than it is to fight for an unsustainable ingredient.
Wow. That is a great story of really savvy, coordinated strategy, 100 NGOs. I mean, that's amazing. And a story in itself, I'm sure, to have that much collaboration across the country and to have that moment where the industry says, yeah, okay, let's simplify this, right?
Yeah, it was very instructive on how to approach, other issues of plastic pollution and what kind of power solidarity brings to a given campaign. And, you know, and ultimately it really boiled down to 100 NGOs saying the same five things and really creating some sort of simplicity in messaging.
Mm. Yeah, that's key. Now, I can't help but with my facilitator hat just have at least one question about that. So I'm assuming you guys all get together at some point to have a big strategy meeting to align on that messaging. And I imagine you had work groups and that sort of thing to keep the work moving forward.
Yeah, so, you know, we developed sort of working groups, talking points, and, you know, we went to key states where we thought we could pass this and found relevant NGOs that are working on statewide politics and fed them information as best we could and fed them intel and experience of, you know, how this bill was running in California and New York and other places and working on strategy, but really creating discipline within this movement to say the same things and to go after the same policy. Mm. And it was actually a very simplified form of organizing, which in that elegance is what was the key to victory.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you said that the MicroBees campaign has given a nice model to some subsequent campaigning efforts in the plastic movement. Can you give some specific examples?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most interesting developments in, you know, plastics campaigning was on the data side. You know, we've been talking a lot about plastic in the ocean and effect on animals, and we have a movement of people who are affected by plastic pollution at every stage of the supply chain. And so, connecting those stories to that part of the supply chain is really important. So with, you know, this effort we're doing, the story of plastic, you know, we are looking at frontline communities around refineries that are cracking ethane to make polyethylene. And we find these horrific human health stories and these grave injustices. And so we needed to reframe it. And I think one of the coolest examples was what is called the brand audit. You know, the intervention that has been sort of approved by industry has been to do beach cleanups. And we've been doing this for years and years and years. And from a narrative standpoint, we recognized we needed to hack that because that kept the onus of responsibility on the citizen and not the company creating the pollution. Mm-hmm. So we developed this idea called the brand audit. And in solidarity, we've been able to get like 300 different NGOs in on one day to gather all this data of what brands are polluting the environment. And that has permanently shifted the narrative to put the companies on their heels.
Yeah. So, and you've been doing that all over the world, right? Not just in the US, but people in Southeast Asia where the plastic pollution is even more intense than we see on the beaches here by a lot. Those people are also involved in the brand audit, right?
Yeah, it's been a worldwide movement and it's only scaling because the data is so powerful and you can't argue with it. It's essentially sort of agnostic. Like not every group that participates in the brand audit is a campaigning group. They may be an education group. They may be a zero waste group, but they may not have a campaigning arm. But this was sort of an agnostic way for everybody in the movement to create data and evidence together that, you know, the sum of its parts is very powerful. And industry, you know, we had the CEO of Unilever at Davos earlier this year, you know, say on the microphone in a public forum, sometimes they think we're in the branded trash business. And that
wow.
is, that was a huge milestone where mm-hmm. we had successfully changed the narrative around responsibility for this pollution.
Mm, I love that phrase too, branded trash. That's a powerful term to be using to talk about plastic pollution and putting the attention on the creators of the waste rather than those of us as consumers, you know, oh, I forgot my Tupperware again. It's my fault, you know, which, as you mentioned, is messaging we're trying to get away from.
Indeed.
Yeah. So tell us more about the story of plastic. I know you've been traveling for a lot of the last year or so, going around the world, interacting with people all over the world. As you mentioned, seeing some horrible injustices, and I'm sure some really inspiring stories too. Tell us just a little bit about the journey of creating the movie to start.
Yeah, the story of plastic was something we have wanted to do for a really long time. And, you know, I came at this issue from an oceans standpoint. And as I said earlier, when you start asking questions, you start going upstream. And then you start asking questions about where is this stuff going? And we recognize, you know, we have a global movement of people who are heroes fighting back against this unjust system, but their stories aren't necessarily being told on the world stage. So we set out to tell that story, you know, and starting in the United States, which is the biggest oil and gas producer in the world. And, you know, the thing is, like, a lot of people don't make the meta connections that if you see a fracking well in North Dakota, that could be tied directly to plastic pollution in a river in Southeast Asia, because that fuel source is being piped and then going by ship to Asia or to Europe to make plastic products. And those products are escaping into the environment. So one, we wanted to tell the story of that system and also the sort of heroes along the way who are fighting back against that system and how woefully out of touch industry is with both the scope of the problem and the scope of what the real solutions are.
And the movie itself comes out this fall. What can we expect to learn watching the film?
Well, you know, it's going to be a little different, I think, than a lot of films on plastic, because we're starting at a point, you know, in the conversation around extraction. And, you know, I don't think viewers fully understand, you know, you see headlines that, you know, recycling is broken, it's not working, but you don't actually know how broken it is and where our stuff is going and what it looks like. I mean, there's this place in Surabaya, Indonesia, where when you get there, you see fields of plastic waste, like, I mean, to the horizon, like you can't see the ground. There are shrubs sticking out, there are trees sticking out. There are children playing in piles of plastic, much like children, you know, play in piles of leaves here, who have never known a world different, that this is normal, you know, that this plastic is there. And then when you go into those piles, you start pulling brands out like Target, Trader Joe's, Bob's Red Mills, like, you know, Nestle, like all this stuff that you know is coming from Europe, Australia, the United States, Canada, New Zealand. You can readily pick these products up. And so this is the story of where away actually is. And when that stuff gets there, there's nowhere for it to go. Like, waste pickers go through a little bit of it, you know, the stuff that has some value. But because so much keeps coming, they can cherry pick only the best materials. And if they, you know, exhaust a pile of plastic, they know that, you know, 3 to 5 trucks are going to come the next day. And to get rid of the rest of the stuff, they burn it because there's nowhere for it to go. And that causes all sorts of problems from a human health standpoint, and also a contamination of watersheds, agricultural fields, you name it. I mean, it's horrific. Mm-hmm. And this is what recycling is. And I don't think people understand that when you throw something in a recycling bin here, you are literally playing Russian roulette with that stuff. And there's this idea that it's going somewhere that's safe, and it's being transformed into a new product, and all of this is great. But actually, you know, because there's so much volume in the system, that system is really broken.
Mm. Yeah, and it sounds like part of what people will get from the film is a deeper understanding of how plastic pollution is not just an environmental issue, it's a human rights and a justice issue as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, people don't necessarily recognize, you know, where this stuff comes from and where it goes and who's affected along the way. But I also don't think they know about, you know, what the real sort of solutions being scaled on the ground are and who are the proprietors of those solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get to see sort of a different face of the movement that has been, you know, not necessarily at the table, because the whole formulation around this issue has been from an oceans perspective. So this is conferences that are ocean people and the UN ocean advocacy, you know, the conventions that are working on oceans. And so you miss a lot of important players along the supply chain. So our film is setting out to really change that dialogue of where the pollution begins and where it ends and who are the people fighting the system along the way. Because a zero waste activist in Manila, Philippines, may or may not be working to, you know, solve ocean plastic pollution, but she is definitely working to solve it in a neighborhood level.
Can you give us a teaser, a story that inspired you about the kind of heroes that you met along the way creating the film?
Yeah, so I was in Manila, Philippines, and, you know, we have a number of colleagues there working to transform at the countrywide level how waste is managed in the Philippines. Because it's not that the Philippines lacks infrastructure, it's that their infrastructure is different than our infrastructure here. And their infrastructure can't handle low-value, unrecyclable plastic. It just can't. It's not designed for that. So seeing redesign of waste management in Manila to be decentralized, and what I mean by that is we have a centralized model in the U.S. where a truck, you put your stuff to the curb, the truck comes, and it, you know, picks everything up. They don't even have that kind of waste collection in most places in Manila, so they had to build it. And the problem is you can't, the traffic's so bad, you can't just get a truck, you know, to move through the city freely and pick up waste. So you had to create a decentralized infrastructure where you have essentially push carts going door to door every single day, except for Sundays. And you have source segregated waste, because if you want to get value from recyclables, you don't want the plastic to be contaminated with broken glass and food. So the residents who before this didn't have a collection service are asked to segregate their waste at source. So when the waste workers pick it up, you can get as much value out of that. And about 60% of the waste is food waste. And so that's being composted. Paper and metals are being recycled, as is glass, and then recyclable plastic. And what shakes out is what's called residual waste. And this is about 12 to 20% of the waste stream that is neither recyclable or compostable. And so then we target that stuff for elimination. And so this is a real success story, because now we have reduced the plastic problem down to a few products and a few materials.
Wow. So just to pause on that stat for a second, because my understanding is globally, it's something like less than 25% gets recycled, might even be lower. And you're saying this decentralized approach, it's more like 80%+ gets recycled or composted. Am I hearing that right? Yeah,
exactly. 80% gets either recycled or composted, and very little has to go to landfill. And the most inspiring thing about this is, like, you know, we always worry as advocates that our current system, our capitalist system, can't be it can't be overturned enough to be able to create real progress, because a lot of the pollution that we see is predicated on externalizing the costs of that pollution onto the environment or the public. So, like, many products that we use every single day, if they were to pay, you know, if the producers of those products were to pay for managing that material at the end of life, it simply wouldn't be profitable. And so, like, this sort of pollution is predicated on being shipping this and externalizing it to developing world nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so the beauty of the system is we're seeing massive amounts of reduction and leakage into river sheds and oceans. And we're also able to target the materials that just don't belong on planet Earth. And it's cheaper. It's much, much cheaper than what countries are spending now.
And does it provide jobs? I mean, I'm wondering if it's decentralized and you have these door-to-door waste pickers, is it also helping with employment?
Yeah, so it's formalizing sort of the waste picker trade. Like, you know, waste picker is essentially a free agent, and he or she is, you know, going through a given area and picking up mostly number one plastics because those are the most valuable. And with this, you formalize that waste picker into, you know, a civil servant, a waste worker with an hourly wage plus an incentive to collect everything, because they are able to sell those recyclables for, you know, personal profit. So it's taking a waste picker and turning him or her into a civil servant. And that brings a lot of benefits with it, both from a wage standpoint, but also just being seen in a community as a valuable member of that community who's providing an invaluable service.
Yeah.
And that does a lot for, you know, I think anybody's personal satisfaction with regard to their work.
That's beautiful. It has me wondering, you know, I on my street, we get our recycling picked up on Mondays, and early Monday morning, you'll hear people walking around the neighborhood trying to gather what they can for the glass, which has a bottle deposit here in California. So I do get curious if there might be some parts of this model that could be lessons for us here in the U.S.
Well, and I think we need to really work on fixing the supply side and not work so much on the demand side. So one of the problems is virgin plastic is so cheap because there's such a massive fracking boom. There's such a glut of hydrocarbons in the market that it's very hard for recycled resins to compete with virgin plastic. So one of the biggest drivers we're working on now and what we advocate for in the story of plastic is to mandate through the regulatory process that all brands have to have minimum recycled content thresholds in their products. So what that does is it triggers a suite of things. One, if you're a brand who knows that you have to get back plastic to make a new product, you're going to design for recyclability. Two, if it becomes law, it levels the playing field, and now you see venture capital going into building recycling infrastructure domestically. And so you don't have to export this stuff, you know, to developing world countries anymore, which incidentally is going to very quickly become impossible. Like, China doesn't want our trash, and they used to take 45% of the world's plastic. Now India doesn't, now Thailand doesn't, now Vietnam doesn't, et cetera, and so forth. And we're going to run out of places. We're going to run out of ways very quickly.
Mm-hmm. So part of what you're describing to me as someone who's also been involved in the Break Free movement is what's so powerful and exciting about being involved in the Break Free movement. And you talked about the solidarity piece and also the way that the whole movement is really being smart about slowing down to include those who are in frontline communities and who are most impacted by the issue, and to also be strategic from a systemic perspective to understand that we need to address the supply issue and not just the demand issue, or we're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think what's really interesting about the Break Free from Plastic movement is everybody sort of came to the conclusion that they were banging their head against the wall working individually.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, progress was very slow, and that the scale of the movement to address the problem was degrees of scale smaller than the problem itself. So that, you know, was the impetus to create a new sort of movement strategy. But the thing is, with movements, you can't mandate, you can't like write a strategy and say, okay, people, go do this. What you have to do is you have to bring people in to develop that strategy. So we started with an international steering committee of folks for each of us to learn the challenges and the opportunities from different cultural perspectives. And that was, you know, a steep learning curve for all of us. And eventually, we're able to take a strategic framework that would actually work across the entire supply chain and work multiculturally and, you know, multilinguistically. And then we invited a bunch of other NGOs into the room and said, can you help us build out this framework and own a piece of that work? And so, you know, we set out with a first strategic meeting in Tagaytay, Philippines, and we built the Break Free strategy. And now there's over 1,400 groups who both invest in the vision and principles of that strategy, but also execute and intervene at different parts of the supply chain.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible organizing. And it's both sophisticated and, to your point about the lessons from the microbead story, also simple in certain ways, right? And that balance of coordinated international vision and some principles that everybody's aligned on and signs on for. And by the way, if you're listening and you haven't checked it out, breakfreefromplastic.org, you can sign on as an individual or an organization, read all about it. But also, as you said, that there's autonomy. Groups are going to do what they do. And then you get this sort of organic emergent intelligence of these thousands of people all over the world organizing. It reminds me of Paul Hawkins' phrase that the third sector is humanity's immune response to our ecological crisis. And it feels to me like the Break Free movement is striking a beautiful balance between that emergent organic approach and being coordinated enough and smart about coordinated strategy to be really effective.
Yeah, I mean, it's always bumpy when you're, you know, trying to formalize strategy, but at the same time, not take control. And so
It's
a very push-pull sort of yin-yang sort of dance that you have to do. But largely, I feel like it's working. And, you know, I think that the interesting part of it is just the level of trust that has developed between disparate communities with very different lived experiences, coming all to the table and saying, okay, we're going to trust each other because there's power in numbers and there's power in story. And, you know, if you're somebody from a rich coastal place on the California coast who's invited to a conference to speak on the plastic pollution issue, before, you know, that person was just talking about the impacts to wildlife and, you know, showing photos of polluted beaches. But now, increasingly, they're also telling the stories of their colleagues who are on the other end of the system, you know, living by refineries. And to wit, the people who are living by refineries that, you know, have been working on these issues for 30 plus years now are framing it through a material lens that people understand. Now you're seeing increasingly the people who are concerned with plastics issues recognize that by the time they buy it in the store, it's already affected real people's lives. It is already pollution. And so, like, we're changing the definition of plastic pollution, you know, to recognize that this pollutes every step of the way. And it's not just when it gets into the ocean that it becomes pollution. It's pollution the second it leaves the wellhead.
Yeah. Well, Steve, is there anything else that we haven't had a chance to touch on that you might want to share, particular stories that have been inspirational to you recently in your long road with this plastic pollution work?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what's really nice to see is the sophistication of the movement now. And, you know, all along the way, I was in a youth conference that this organization called Algalita Marine Research Foundation organized in Southern California. And the goal is for me to be a mentor to, like, mostly high school age students and, you know, help them with their campaigns. And these are, you know, mostly small scale or they're school wide. But the sophistication of those campaigns kind of blew my mind. I was like, wow, even though you're just applying this to, like, one school, like, this is a system you would want applied, like, city or statewide. And so, you know, the kids are getting really savvy with how to make change. And it's not just in the United States. It's from all over the world. And so that is really heartening to me, because I think the younger generation really recognizes that plastic is an existential threat. And they have enough tools and information from all the sort of people who've come before them to really create these, like, you know, mushroom campaigns all over the place that are achieving real results. And that's very heartening.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great to hear.
And the last thing I'll say is, if you're interested in the Story of Plastic movie or potentially screening it for an audience, go to storyofplastic.org and sign up, and you will get updates of when all those materials and the film is available.
Awesome. Great. Well, Stu, I feel like there's a million more questions I could ask you, but we should probably close out here. But I do want to just mention a couple of things that we didn't touch on. Definitely go to the Story of Stuff website. You can learn about their Unbottle Water campaign, which is another project they've been working on to stop companies like Nestle from bottling water that should not be bottled in local watersheds. There's also some bottle deposit work that Story of Stuff is getting started campaigning on. And as Stiv mentioned, the Story of Plastic movie will be coming out this fall. So you can go to their website, sign up for their newsletter to stay tuned. Go to breakfreefromplastic.org to find out more about the international movement we've been talking about. And Stiv, thank you so much for your time and for all the incredible work you do to support the growth and sharp strategy of the movement.
Okay, talk soon. Bye.
And that's our show. If you like what you're hearing, help spread the word. Subscribe to the Indisposable Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Add a review, talk us up, try our 5-friend challenge. Share some highlights from today's show with a handful of people in your life who could use an uplift. Nobody spreads a message like you. The Indisposable Podcast is brought to you by Upstream, sparking innovative solutions to plastic pollution, envisioning a world without it, and empowering businesses, communities, and individuals to imagine and co-create this future with us. You can find resources mentioned on today's episode, as well as learn more about Upstream's work at www.upstreamsolutions.org. Follow us on social, support us on Patreon, and join the movement. There's a better way than throwaway.